BBC News at 3 o'clock. This is Justine Green. Boris Johnson has said it may be possible to phase out social distancing measures in time for Christmas, as he set out the timetable for more restrictions being eased. The Prime Minister said it was up to businesses to decide if it's safe for staff to return to the office. Professor Christina Pagel is the Director of the Clinical Operational Research Unit at UCL and a member of the Independent Sage Group. She's concerned about the speed of measures being relaxed.
We know from other countries that have opened that it takes something like 4 to 5 weeks before you start seeing a sustained increase in cases after relaxation. We're not there yet. In fact, we just keep opening every 2-3 weeks something else without waiting to see what the impact was of the most recent one. And that's something where I'm quite worried, is that maybe it'll be too late by the time you realise it.
Councils are being given greater powers to clamp down on local outbreaks of coronavirus, which Mr Johnson said would be supported by an effective testing system. A Metropolitan Police officer has been suspended and another placed on restricted duties after a video appeared to show one of them kneeling on a man's neck. An independent investigation has begun into the incident at Islington in North London on Thursday. Our Home Affairs correspondent Danny Shaw reports.
The video footage shot by someone at the scene shows a struggle between a suspect on the ground who's black and two police officers. They'd been called to reports of a fight. One officer has a hand on the man's head and appears to be kneeling on the man's neck. Witnesses said they were worried for his safety after the case of George Floyd, who died when a policeman in America knelt on his neck for almost 8 minutes. In a strongly worded statement, Sir Steve House, the Met's second highest ranking officer, said the video footage was extremely disturbing. Some of the techniques used cause me great concern, he said. They are not taught in police training.
The owner of the Zizi and Ask Italian chains is shutting 75 restaurants with the loss of up to 1,200 jobs. The closures are part of a rescue deal for the Azzurri Group. 225 restaurants and shops will continue to operate. Football and Leeds United have been promoted to the Premier League after an absence of 16 years. They went up without playing, thanks to their closest rivals West Bromwich Albion losing 2-1 to Huddersfield Town. The Leeds captain Liam Cooper said the players felt unstoppable under the leadership of their manager Marcelo Bielsa.
It's still not properly sunk in. I'm sure it will over the next couple of days, but we know we've got a game to look forward to. But that'll go on the back burner for now. We're just over the moon. Our club and our fans and our players, we've sacrificed so much. We've been in the doldrums for 16 years. And to be part of this team and to lead this team to promotion back to where we know we've always belonged, it's unbelievable.
Elsewhere, West Ham have taken a big step to securing their place in the Premier League next season with a 3-1 win over fellow strugglers Watford. And that's the BBC News at 3 minutes past 3.
Welcome to The First Time with me, Matt Everett. This is the series where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and look at the seminal first musical moments that shaped their lives and their careers. And this is the last in this series, and we're ending with a big one. A man who's not only in one of the biggest and best rock bands in the world right now, but was also an integral part of one of the most important and influential groups ever. He's also one of the greatest drummers of all time and possibly the nicest man in rock. My guest on The First Time this week is Dave Grohl. As the Foo Fighters prepare to take their epic Sonic Highways tour around the world and headline Glastonbury, no less, Dave sits down to look back at some of the music and events that have meant the most to him. He discusses his early influences, his first ever punk gig and how it changed the path of his life, and playing with Scream, his first proper band in Washington, D.C. in the 90s. He also chats about recording Nirvana's Nevermind at LA's famous Sound City Studios and the creation of the In Utero album with Steve Albini. He also talks about the making of the Sonic Highways documentaries, as well as his passion for the Beatles, Neil Young, Tom Petty, and obviously his beloved Led Zeppelin. But I started by asking, as I do with all my guests, when Dave was first aware of music.
In America, on AM radio in the 70s was amazing. Because it was all this like super melodic soft rock, like 10cc and Jerry Rafferty and Andrew Gold and Carly Simon and stuff like that. And my mother sang when she was young, so I would sing with her in the car, and she taught me how to harmonize. So I would sing the lead line and she would sing a harmony, and that's when I started to understand, like, oh, so if you put different notes together, it makes a chord. That's what I remember, like driving around in the summertime, going to the lake, and my mother singing like a Phoebe Snow song or something.
So what about the first record that you owned? What was that?
Well, I remember my first record, which was this compilation record by this company called KTEL. It was big in the 70s. And my mother was a public school teacher, and so we didn't have a record player in the house, but on the weekends, she would bring the really crappy public school system turntables home. Like, they just smelled like burning wood or whatever, and then you'd open it up and the speaker was built in. So she brought it home one weekend. I was like, let's go get a record. We went to the drugstore and I bought this record, this KTEL compilation, and it had Edgar Winter's Frankenstein. I mean, it had like Fly Robin Fly. Like, that's the way, I like it. But it had Edgar Winter's Frankenstein on it.
That's a big tune.
It totally changed my life. It's like, oh my God. We'll be right back.
was going to ask you about first time you fell in love with the Beatles, because you've talked about, obviously, your passion for them and kind of how that melodic sensibility infuses your stuff. And the record, the new record, I just found out. Photos done by Ringo. The back cover picture is done by Ringo Starr.
How great is that? Well, he, you know, he's a photographer, and he took a lot of great pictures of the Beatles and other people as well. He released a book called Photograph, which is beautiful. It has all these gorgeous pictures that he took. And I went and spoke at this book launch for him. And when it came time to do pictures for the record, someone called and said, okay, it's time to do band pictures. I'm like, oh, God, like, I hate doing that. And who do you want to use? You want to use blah, blah, blah? Nah, we did that. You want to use blah, blah, blah? Nah, we've done that. And then I thought, are there any, like, musicians that take pictures? I just thought, I'll call Ringo. And we talked about it. And he's so cool, man, and so humble. He was just like, he's like, well, I'm a little nervous, you know? Like, he wasn't really sure how to do it, because a lot of those iconic pictures that he took of the Beatles, they were just hanging out in the hotel room because they couldn't go outside because they'd get torn to shreds by the fans. So the best pictures of the Beatles, I think, were taken by Ringo, because he caught those really candid moments in the hotel rooms. And, you know, when they first came to America, in those early pictures, if you see the pictures of the Beatles, they've got a cigarette in one hand and a camera in the other. So he agreed to do it, and he got some really great pictures.
What's the Beatles track we should play at this juncture?
Well, my favorite Beatles track, I think, might be Hey Bulldog. That's a good one. And I loved it when I was young, but then when my daughter started listening to the Beatles, she also said, like, that's the song. And so we kind of bonded on that.
Let's talk about the first punk rock gig, the one that changed your life.
Oh, yeah.
At the Cubby Bear, Chicago, 1982.
Yeah.
It really did completely alter the path of your life, didn't
it? Oh, totally. Where I grew up in Virginia, just outside of Washington, D.C., unless you were brilliant and had money and were going to go to some fancy college somewhere, career opportunity was just sort of like you were either going to be a mason or you were going to do, like, drywalling, or I used to call them Virginia jobs, you know, just labor. And I worked those jobs, but, and I played music in a neighborhood band
And we did like Bowie covers and Stones covers. And then I went up to Chicago for this vacation. And my cousin took me to this club to see this punk rock band called Naked Ray Gun. And I went to this dingy little club and the band got on stage. They were so aggressive and loud and simple, you know, because that's the thing. It's like you're used to seeing these like monolithic mega rock bands that just seem like superheroes, and you have a poster and you listen to the record and you think that's kind of cool, but you could never imagine doing it just because they're so, you know, good. And then you go see a punk rock band like just like spill blood all over the stage and change your life, and it just makes you realize like, oh, I could do that, and that's really fun and exciting. And so I went home and decided like, okay, that's what I'm going to do with my life. I can't imagine that it's ever going to like keep the heat on in my building, but that's what I want to do for the rest of my life. It totally changed my life. It was the most inspiring thing that's probably ever happened to me, just to see that right in your face. And when you're a kid too, those are like formative, impressionable years. I loved music and I had learned to play guitar by listening to Beatles records. And then all of a sudden I see this band bash out three chords and 2 minute songs. I'm just like, this is amazing. You know, it just totally changed my life.
Something else in the documentary that really stood out was that first gig with Scream in DC and your experience afterwards.
Yeah.
The kind of protest. Talk us through that, because it sounded like a spiritual baptism as well as a musical baptism.
Yeah.
In a way.
It's like going to the river. I mean, honestly, you know, while I was in Chicago, my cousin said, she showed me a record collection and I started finding these albums in her collection of bands from Washington, D.C. I had no idea that there was this huge, influential punk rock scene in Washington, D.C. So when I went back to D.C., I mean, we had bands like Minor Threat and the Bad Brains and Scream and all these bands that were amazing that were right in my backyard. I had no clue. So when I came back to D.C., I started going to see shows and stuff. But the D.C. music scene was different. And it's something, I mean, it's a good example of what we talk about in the Sonic Highways episodes, is how the environment influences the music. Not just the room you record in, but the city that you live in and how that winds up getting under your skin and getting into your music. You know, Washington, D.C. is like, it's the political capital of America. And so it's inevitable that that's going to somehow, by osmosis, make its way into what you do. You're just surrounded by it. And so somewhere like in the mid-80s, this guy named Mark Anderson, he had an organization called Positive Force. He sort of married the music scene with politics, and it all came together with a community of people that realized like, okay, well, we're a community, we can actually get out and do things to change. So at the time, apartheid was still happening, and all like 100 of us would just grab drums and stand out in front of the South African embassy as traffic went by and just beat the hell out of drums for hours, you know, until the cops chased us away. So it was like stuff like that was happening all the time. We were doing Amnesty International benefits and animal rights benefits and things like that, because music is such a powerful communicator that not only can it reach out and attract people to something that you're trying to that you're supporting, but it also makes it like you're celebrating life at the same time. So DC was and is an amazing city for music because it's important. Like there's something else going on. So the first show I played with Scream, I mean, that was a big enough deal because they were my heroes in Washington, D.C. And we like marched up to an embassy and, you know, lit it on fire. I can't remember what we did. Something like that.
Neil Young. You mentioned Neil Young before. When did you first fall in love with...
I have an older sister, Lisa. She's 3 years older than me. So she was like my music teacher as a kid. When I first started listening to Kiss and Rush and Led Zeppelin, hard rock, she was kind of already moved on to Bowie and Prince and things like that. So, but she was always one step ahead of me. So then when I was listening to crazy hardcore punk rock, she was really into Neil Young. So as a punk rocker, it wasn't really cool to listen to Neil Young. So I would kind of wait until she would go to sleep or wait until she would go to school, and I'd grab her records and listen to them. And she had the greatest hits collection, Decade, that compilation of all of his music, you know. Mm. And I swear to God, I still listen to that album, like, from front to back. And it just reminds me of being a kid in Virginia. And, you know, one of the things that was kind of lacking in a lot of that hardcore punk rock that I was listening to was melody and craft, like songwriting, you know. And not only is Neil a hero today because he's always walked it like he talked it, and he has the integrity and the history of like a real legend, you know. He's amazing. But he's an incredible songwriter, you know. So people call him the godfather of grunge because he's always played what people consider like really like feedbacky, grungy, loud rock. But sort of behind all that is a really brilliant songwriter. I love him to death. Plus he's a great dude.
I think I'd like to go back. A woman that I'd like to get to know, living there. Everybody seems to wonder what it's like down here. I gotta get away from this day to day running around. Everybody knows this is nowhere. Everybody knows. Every time I think about back home, it's cool and breezy. I wish that I could be there right now, just passing time. Everybody seems to wonder what it's like down here. I gotta get away from this day-to-day running around. Everybody knows this is nowhere.
So Sonic Highways, that series of documentaries, isn't your directorial debut. That was the Sound City documentary from 2013. Sound City being the place in California where amazing albums by Fleetwood Mac and Rage Against the Machine and Tom Petty were all recorded. And it's where you did Nevermind with Nirvana. Can you remember first arriving at that legendary studios?
You wouldn't really associate punk rock with Sound City or Sound City with punk rock, because there's so many like you think of Santana and you think of Neil Young and Tom Petty and Fleetwood Mac. What that studio represents or represented is important, you know? Like, Nirvana made sense at Sound City because we were kind of alike. We didn't need much. We just needed to be ourselves. And it's sort of the same with Sound City. You know, Sound City had that same board, mixing desk, recording console, for 40 years. And they never upgraded and they never changed it because they didn't need to. It did what it did, and it had a vibe and it had a sound, and it was a one-of-a-kind board. Same with The Room. The Room was just linoleum tile and like perforated soundboard on the wall. It wasn't fancy, but it didn't need to be because it just sounded so good. It was entirely real.
So when Nirvana went there to record, you know, we just went there because it was cheap. We didn't know anything about it. We'd never been. And we walked in and, you know, we thought it was a dump when we saw it. It was sort of funny that we were coming to Los Angeles to make our big major label record. And we get there. We're like, oh, my God, this place is a shithole. But it sounded so good. And I mean, you know, we weren't used to the state of the art, wonderful new studios anyway. But I mean, to me, it represents something really important. And almost like a lesson for everyone, or everyone should realize that the most important thing is that you be yourself, you know? Sound City never tried to be anything but Sound City. Nirvana never tried to be anything but Nirvana. You know, fortunately, when Nevermind became popular, Sound City became popular again too. And we were always, I was very happy about that. Like, oh wow, now all of these people are appreciating it for the same reason that we did. Without any words, I got so high, strapped till I bled. Love myself better than you. Know it's wrong. What should I do? The finest day that I've ever had is when I learned to cry on command. Love myself better than you. Know it's wrong. What should I do?
You're listening to The First Time with me, Matt Everett, and my guest this week, Dave Grohl. And that, from 1991's Nevermind album, was On a Plane by Nirvana.
Thank you.
I'm Matt Everett, and this is the first time where we look at the key first moments in an artist's career. And that track was Everlong by Foo Fighters, featuring drums and vocals and lyrics from my guest this week, Dave Grohl. Among the many people featured in Dave's recent Sonic Highways documentary series is Steve Albini, the recording engineer who helped make Nirvana's In Utero album, a famously astute, uncompromising and single-minded guy. I asked Dave about their first meeting.
Well, I first met him when Nirvana recorded the record In Utero. I had never met him before that, but I knew his reputation, and his reputation definitely preceded him. You know, he was like the smartest, most cynical producer, music critic, band leader, pundit. Like, he was just terrible. Everyone's scared of him, you know? But then you see pictures of him, and he just kind of looks like this skinny little guy. But I mean, he's just smarter and funnier and better at everything than everyone else in the world. So, and he had made so many records that we loved. He'd made Pixies records and Breeders records and Jesus Lizard records and Big Black records. And these were bands that Nirvana really loved. So when we went to record with them, I was nervous because I knew what kind of dude, and I just thought he would hate me because I'm such an idiot, you know. And we got along great. I think he treated me like a pet, actually. So we got along great because I was the drummer. But yeah, I mean, he's one of a kind, and I'm glad that I had the opportunity to tell his story, because I think he sets a great example not only for musicians but also for the industry and how to think outside of just conventional business, you know. And you know, he lives to do things that are real and passionate, and his level of integrity is just like, he's kind of unwavering. He just won't bend, and he's stubborn for all the right reasons. So I love him to death. I think he's amazing. What else should I be?
Oh! 20th anniversary of Foo Fighters, yeah. or 20th anniversary of the name or the idea, I guess.
Yeah.
What do you remember about that first record? Because the legend is it was like, yeah, you did like 12 songs in 6 days or something.
Yeah.
Is that actually how it was?
Yeah. Yeah, because I didn't think it was a record. I mean, had I taken it seriously, I might have spent a little more time on it.
Yeah, but, it's a bit late now.
No, I mean, even before I was in Nirvana, I had this friend who had an 8-track studio in his basement, my friend Barrett Jones. And so I would go to his house and record his music with him. And then I'd always say, hey, do you have any tape left? And he'd have like maybe 3 minutes left at the end of a reel. And I would record something by myself where I'd play the drums first and then I'd overdub guitars and then I'd overdub a bass and then I'd overdub a vocal and I'd take it home and listen to it. And it like sounded like a group, you know, it sounded like a band. And I would trick people and play like, hey, this is this new band. And they'd say like, what? That sucks. Who's that? I'm like, this is me. So, but it became this experiment. And then the entire time I was in Nirvana, I was doing that in my basement too. And I didn't let anybody hear it. And I wasn't about to introduce any of my crap to Nirvana. It was like, well, Kurt's writing some pretty good songs right now. I'll just sort of do this in my basement. And so I did. And then after Nirvana was over, I just didn't know what to do. And I was in a dark place and I didn't want to join another band. And finally, I just got off the couch and said, you know what? I'm going to pick 12 of my favorite songs that I've recorded over the last 5 years and go to this studio down the street from the house and book 5 days and just record it. Because 5 days to me was an eternity. I usually only had 5 minutes at my friend Barrett's because I was imposing already, asking for free tape. And so I got 5 days in the studio and I was so prepared, man. I knew what I was going to record. I knew what I was going to record each day. And I had this day blocked out for this. And then the last day I was going to do vocals, then mix on the sixth day or whatever. And I just banged it out. But there was no band and there was no label. And it was just for fun. And then that tape started getting around and people said, hey, do you want to put out this record? I'm like, that's not a record. It's not even a band. And then it just kind of turned into the Foo Fighters.
Visiting is pretty. Visiting is good. Seems that all they ever wanted was a brother.
Seems that all they ever wanted was a market. Their balloons are pretty. Big and say they should.
When did you first fall in love with Zeppelin? He says, looking at the Zeppelin tats that you've got going on.
Led Zeppelin is like the clouds and the air and the trees. It's just everywhere all the time, you know. Someone's older brother has a record. It's on the radio. Its song remains the same as on TV. It's just like, it's just everywhere, and it should be, because it's important for people to have that as some sort of musical foundation. Like, you can listen to Justin Bieber, that's cool. Just make sure you get a Zeppelin record first. You know what I'm saying? So, yeah, I mean, it's such a huge part of my life. I was really, really, really into Led Zeppelin for, oh God, years. I mean, bootlegs and bootleg videos, and I really loved watching them play, you know, because I never got to see him play because I was too young.
What's the track we should play?
I mean, honestly, I can't. It's hard to pick a favorite Zepp track. It's like picking your favorite child. Trampled Underfoot has always been one of my favorite songs, because you've got John Paul Jones on that clav. It sounds so cool, and there's the one epic drum roll at the end that's so fast it doesn't even sound like it's single hits. It's like
I'm
songs, eight cities, eight rooms, eight desks, eight studios. I mean, was there ever a point when you were like, we're not going to be able to make this work?
I had no idea what I was getting myself into. I really had no idea. And it looked good on paper. I'm like, oh, this would be great. That would be amazing. And this is such a fun way to make a record. And especially after 20 years as a band, we could just walk into a studio and make a record. That's so boring. So I came up with the idea, and then the wheels started in motion, and we just kind of started building it and building it and building it, and then it snowballed, and it just turned into what it is now. And it's the most overwhelming thing I've ever done in my entire life. Like, I have three kids at home. That's a cinch compared to what we've been doing with this thing. And so 2 years of planning and writing and editing and mixing and recording and interviewing and editing is just insane.
Because I think it's as much about you and the band as it is about America. What have you learned then?
Oh my God. Even if there weren't cameras or anything, that would have been the most rewarding year of my life, because now I know stuff and I'm excited, you know, like, it's great. I can actually sit down and, because now people come and ask me questions about Austin, Texas, or they ask me questions about, and I only know what I know. But I mean, it's the great thing about having the opportunity and the resource to do this is that I get to tell these stories to people who otherwise might have never heard them, you know.
And the final song we're going to play,
we should play the song called Congregation, which we recorded in Nashville for our Sonic Highways TV series here on the BBC.
That's a nice plug. Good to speak to you, man. Thank you very much.
Good to see you.
This is Radio 2 on the BBC Sounds app, on your smart speaker and on 88 to 91 FM.
BBC News at 4 o'clock. This is Justine Green. Local authorities in England will be able to use new powers from today to deal with spikes of coronavirus infection in their area. The Local Government Association has welcomed the measures, saying the powers to close premises and prevent events from going ahead should help avoid the need for more drastic lockdowns. The UN Secretary General has strongly criticised the world's biggest powers for failing to act together to tackle the COVID-19 pandemic. Antonio Guterres said poor relations between countries such as the United States and China had exacerbated the problems posed by the virus. A Metropolitan Police officer has been suspended and another placed on restricted duties after a video appeared to show one of them kneeling on a man's neck. Josh Langham saw the incident in North London unfold.
When I went to see what happened, there was a crowd and his knee was still on his neck. Like I told you, when I got down there, his knee was on his neck still. The crowd has told him, take your knee, we're screaming, just take your knee off his neck. So he listened to the crowd and removed his knee.
The Met's Deputy Commissioner, Sir Steve House, said the footage was extremely disturbing and some of the techniques seen were not taught in police training. The police watchdog is investigating. The suspect has since been charged with possession of a knife. Councils have called for smoking to be banned outside pubs, cafes and bars to make them more family-friendly and healthy. The Local Government Association is urging peers to support a move to make all pavement licences subject to them being smoke-free places. Work has begun on a study to understand the risks of singing in public. With music venues and theatres being allowed to open again in August, performers want to know how close they can stand to one another safely. Our arts correspondent David Sillitoe reports.
Happy birthday to you.
In a super clean medical facility in London, scientists from Bristol University and Imperial College are listening to and measuring the output of dozens of people singing Happy Birthday.
Happy birthday to you.
The current government advice is that singers stand 3 metres apart and in limited numbers. The issue is what's coming out of people's mouths other than music. Large droplets usually hit the ground within 2 metres, but there are also tiny particles known as the aerosol, and this can hang in the air for more than an hour in enclosed spaces.
Leeds United fans have been celebrating their club's return to top-flight football. After 16 years, they're back in the Premier League after rivals West Bromwich Albion lost 2-1 to Huddersfield Town. Simon Grayson is a former club manager.
Leeds United back in the Premier League is one of the best things that can happen to the Premier League, and that's not being a Leeds fan and rose-tinted glasses. It is a massive, massive football club, and they're going to get in the rivalries back again. You've got Manchester United, Chelsea, Liverpool.
BBC News at 3 minutes.